briefly about what is happening here. We have King Ajatasattu asking his Brahmin minister Vasakara to go to the Buddha and tell the Buddha, I'm going to attack and destroy the Vajrayans. And then the Buddha tells Vasakara about these seven qualities of the Vajrayans, and presumably he's probably telling him, well, not much point in attacking them because they are so strong because of these seven points. And he's probably trying to dissuade him from actually doing the attacking in the first place. And then Vasakara, having then told Vasakara about these seven qualities of the Vajrayans, and these are qualities that the Buddha himself taught them at some stage in the past, then comes this little paragraph here. So what is the response of Vasakara when he hears about these seven qualities, right? And this is how he responds. There's two little paragraphs in there in 1.5. I'll read them both out, even though we have already looked at the first paragraph. I'll just have a look at them. Then the Lord said to the Brahmin Vasakara, once, Brahmin, when I was at the Sarandada shrine in Vaisali, I taught the Vajrayans these seven principles for preventing decline. And as long as we keep to these seven principles, as long as these seven principles remain in force, the Vajrayans may be expected to prosper and not decline. So these are the seven principles we had a look at the very first installment of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And so this is what the Buddha says. Well, as long as they keep to these things, then they will be very strong. You can't really destroy them or kill them or annihilate them as a king wishes to do. And it's interesting. If you look at those seven principles again, I'm not going to read through them again. They got nothing to do with building up a large army. Got nothing to do with having heaps of weapons or anything like that. It has all to do with how they work together internally. And many of those principles are about things like harmony, right? And how to listen to the arahants. They're all about spiritual qualities, really. Qualities of the mind. If you have the right qualities of mind, you will be protected from external problems. You will be strong because of the way you work together. The Buddha doesn't say that they should build up their arsenals with weapons or anything like that. He just says that this is what really makes you strong as a nation. So that's interesting here. But that's what he says. And then the Brahmin Vasakara responds. And this is where we're kind of starting afresh the part I didn't talk about the first time around. At this, Vasakara replied, Reverend Gautama, if the Vajrayans keep to one, even one of these principles, they may be expected to prosper and not decline, far less all seven. Certainly the Vajrayans will never be conquered by King Ajatasattu by force of arms, but only by means of propaganda and by setting them against one another. And now, Reverend Gautama, may I depart? I am busy and have much to do. Brahmin, do as you think fit. Then Vasakara, rejoicing and delighted at the Lord's words, rose from his seat and departed. And this is what happens, right? You give this beautiful teaching on how to live in harmony together, how to live the spiritual life, live properly the spiritual life. And probably the Buddha, again, trying to dissuade him from attacking, saying it's going to be difficult to attack them, it won't be easy to overpower them, etc. Maybe he's even trying to suggest, maybe these are qualities. You guys, you know, in the Mughal Empire, maybe you should be doing these things as well. And then you too will be safe from external threats and these kind of things. But of course, Vasakara doesn't take it that way. He doesn't see him. He basically turns it around straight away and uses the information given by the Buddha instead for how can we attack them? How can we destroy them? What can we learn from this thing that he has said? So he said, instead of actually using this for spiritual advancement, he used it for worldly advancement. We're going to have to use propaganda, right? I think diplomacy is another word that is mentioned as a translation for this word. So use diplomacy, in other words, some kind of bad diplomacy to break them apart and to destroy them internally. Setting them against one another, mittu bena, the destruction of friendships. In other words, to destroy that harmony and things that they have inside. And that is the way to overcome these Vajrayans. So this is typical of humanity, using even spiritual teachings in the wrong way and using them to for worldly ends rather than for spiritual ends. And you can see this in many places. In fact, Buddha, very interestingly here, says also, I think that's in the, which sutta is that? In the Alagadupama Sutta, the sutta on the simile of the snake, Majjhima Nikaya 22, where he says that if you use the Dhamma in the wrong way, then it kind of backfires on you. Just like when you grab a snake by the tail, the snake will turn around and bite you because of that. In the same way, the Dhamma will bite you back, so to speak, if you use it in the wrong way. And this is a little bit like that. What we're seeing here. So now comes the interesting part that really I wanted to focus on. Is the next paragraph here, and this is the part which I felt I had to do because it's so central to this particular sutta. And remember again, the idea with the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is that here the Buddha is kind of summarizing his teachings, laying down the kind of foundation so that the Sangha would prosper in the future, Buddhism would prosper in the future. Even after he passes away, he knows that his life is coming to an end, and now I have to establish the principles through which the Sangha is going to be able to survive even after I pass away. Because when you have had somebody like the Buddha to teach you, of course, it's a very that kind of presence, that kind of person you can always go to and ask for questions. As soon as they're gone, it leaves a gaping hole in the Buddhist teachings, and you kind of need to fill it somehow. And this is what he's trying to do here to some extent. Fill that hole, fill that sense of loss that is about to happen and to come very soon. So this particular set of factors that he's going to talk about now is precisely about that, how the Sangha and how the Buddhist teaching can last for a long time into the future. And I think I mentioned this on the first time, there is a large number of sets of seven coming after this. It's a bit like they have tacked on a number of sets of seven to kind of expand and flesh out the sutta a little bit. But this particular set of seven is in some ways the most interesting one because it is the first one, and it is unique to this particular sutta. It seems to be related specifically to the idea of keeping Buddhism going in the future. So this is a particularly interesting set, and that is why I wasn't very happy with having forgotten to read it out last time. And this set also exists in all the other versions of this particular sutta. So this is what happens next. Soon after Vasakara had gone, the Lord said, "Ananda, go to whatever monks there are round about Radhagaha and summon them to the assembly hall." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda, and he did so. So the idea here of summoning all the monks, right? The idea here, of course, that this says that this is an important teaching he's going to give. That's why you summon all the monks together. Usually he would just give talks to the local Sangha that is around, but here he actually specifically asks to bring all the monks around. I think the idea here is to say that this is important, what is coming afterwards. Then he came to the Lord, saluted him, or bowed down to him, stood to one side and said, "Lord, the order of monks is assembled. Now is the time for the Lord to do as he sees fit." Then the Lord rose from his seat, went to the assembly hall, sat down on a prepared seat and said, "Monks, I will teach you seven things that are conducive to welfare. Listen, pay careful attention, and I will speak." "Yes, Lord," said the monks, and the Lord said. So here we have these seven factors that are conducive to welfare. I think that it's actually the aparihanya dhamma, the things that lead to non-decline in the future. And then you have this, the standard way the Buddha often starts the sutta, again signifying its importance when he says, "Listen, pay careful attention, and I will speak." So take it on board, learn it by heart, presumably, because that's what they did in those days. And so these are these seven factors, and they are very similar to the seven factors that we have seen that he gave to the Vajrayans before, but here it is then applied to the Sangha instead. So how can the Sangha function in such a way that it leads to the long-term benefit of Buddhism? And of course it's interesting already that fact, the idea that for Buddhism to really succeed and to thrive in the future, the essential thing is that the Sangha succeeds. When the Sangha succeeds, there will be a foundation there for the whole of Buddhism to succeed. Because the Sangha are, I suppose, the people who are practicing this full time. They are the ones who are most likely to have understood these teachings. And they're kind of also the people who carry the teachings with them in those days, especially mentally, in the memory, bringing them into the future, and for that reason, keeping the wheel of the Dhamma rolling into future generations from one era to another one, and from one culture to another one. So the Sangha here is kind of crucial, really, for the long lasting of the Buddhist dispensation. Okay, so what are they supposed to do? And this is what comes next. As long as the monks hold regular and frequent assemblies, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So the first one, to have regular and frequent assemblies. Yeah, this is the first thing that is important. If to understand what this means, sometimes you have to read the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the kind of the discipline or the code of conduct for the monastics. And according to that code of conduct, monks should meet at the very least once a fortnight. They should meet for the Uposatha ceremony when the full moon or the new moon comes out. And then you do the chanting of the Patimokkha or the recitation of the Patimokkha. Patimokkha being the rules for the monastics, right? The main rules for the monastics. You chant that together, and often you have a discussion about the Dhamma or some questions and answers or questions about the Vinaya. All that happens at the same time, usually. So it has almost been, it has been laid down this into the rules that we have to meet frequently and regularly. And interesting, when you meet, you have to meet in unity. Everybody has to be present. You cannot have somebody not coming. So it is, has to be, everybody has to be there. This is one of the rules as well. Except if you have some kind of good reason, valid reason, then you can send your consent, as it says. It's like saying, well, just go ahead with whatever decisions. That is allowable. But generally speaking, everybody should be there. So this is, I think, an interesting one. I think that the meaning behind this is, I think, the idea of having that sense of common purpose, a sense of common movement towards something, a sense that you are heading in the same direction. Very often, if you stay by yourself, if there's too much splitting up of the community, whether it is in the lay community or the monastic community, you have different visions, different ideas of how things work. You don't have a kind of commonality whereby you move in the same direction together, don't have the same understanding. And you can often see that. You see people who live by themselves in complete solitude sometimes. They don't have anyone to correct them. They don't have anyone to discuss views with. They don't have anyone to kind of bounce ideas off or anything like that. And because they lack that, very often they tend to go out on tangents and kind of create a whole new ideology and ideas about what Buddhism is all about. And then they write books, right? And then they kind of, these books are kind of really absolutely different from what anybody else is saying about Buddhist teachings. And this is quite a common thing. And if they are charismatic, then of course they might get some followers, right? Who say, yeah, this person has understood everything. Everybody else has got us wrong. This is the only person who has got things right. Everybody else is fools, but this person, wow, they are really wise. And you see this happening in the Sangha sometimes. That is one of the dangers, I think, of kind of doing everything by yourself and going alone rather than having a sense of community and a sense of bouncing things off each other. Of course, there comes a point when you live by yourself. There comes a point when you go into the forest and you stay in the jungle and you do your practice. But before you do that, you should have attained or reached a very high level of development of the mind before you actually go living by yourself. You should have very solid samadhi, a very solid understanding of the Buddha's teachings. When you have that, then you are ready to do these things. But before that, you should actually stay within the community. And the Buddha says that specifically to certain monks. Certain monks ask him, oh, I want to go and live in the forest. And the Buddha says, wait till you are ready. What is that readiness? When you see that you have attained the first jhana, second jhana, etc., that is the time to head for the forest. So very, very high standard there for when you are ready to live by yourself. And in the meantime, it's important to have that sense of harmony together. And we can see that in any community, if there is too much, one of the reasons why I think Bodhinyana Monastery is a fairly harmonious community is because, precisely because of that. You meet regularly, everybody has ordained there because of Ajahn Brahm, you have one teacher who everybody respects very highly, and because of that, it kind of naturally you become drawn together as a community in that sense. And of course, respecting the Buddha, of course, even before that, but also Ajahn Brahm as a teacher, and then it works out very nicely. So that is the regular and frequent assemblies, which is, I think, an interesting point. Then we have the next one. As long as they meet in harmony, again, this is about the monks, meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. And here, the word for harmony is samagga. And it means harmony on the one hand, but it also has the meaning of unity on the other hand. In other words, everybody must come together. This is the other meaning of this word. The first thing, of course, the more elementary, more basic idea is the idea of unity, unanimity, everybody coming together. This is the more basic idea. And from the fact that everybody comes together, from that, then you have a degree of harmony, because you are, precisely because you are doing things together, sorting things out together. And this, again, is another very basic principle of the monastic order, the idea that you have to meet together, everybody has to be present, everybody has to be there. You cannot have a meeting where somebody is actually missing. And by meeting, I mean like formal meetings, like ordination ceremonies, or any other important business that the Sangha is doing, everybody has to be present. And if somebody is missing, the whole meeting is invalid. Yeah, so very, very high standard for democracy. And then within that meeting, if one person disagrees with the decision, only one single person disagrees, it means that the decision cannot go ahead. So very, again, very idealistic, and of course a much more democratic idea than the ordinary democracy we have in our modern world where the majority rules. Here it is run by absolute majority. Everybody has to agree, otherwise cannot go ahead. And sometimes people think that this must surely lead to gridlock. How can you get anything done if only one person can disagree? But actually, it doesn't. And this is the interesting thing. It doesn't because everybody understands that within that system you have to act in a mature and responsible way. Yeah, if you are going to put up your hand and disagree with everything without thinking about it carefully and even going with the majority when you realize the majority is against your wishes or whatever it is, because of that, it actually works out very well, because people do actually take that responsibility seriously, and they listen to the majority. And if somebody really is against something, then you may be the only person who is against something. You might ask them, you might say, oh, well, you know, would you like to come on board simply because of the majority? Would you be happy to give up your view and then act according to the majority? And very often they will say yes because of that. But what it does, and I think this is the important thing, it creates a very powerful sense of harmony in the monastic community. If you have the rule by majority, there's always people who feel that they are left out, right? If you, wow, the majority is kind of suppressing me and holding me down and bullying me and this kind of things, that might be the feeling you have. If the majority is always right, the minority can just be trampled on, oppression of the minority by the majority, so to speak. But here, everybody gets pulled along. Everybody has a say. Everybody has to agree. It means that you get a fairly conservative sangha, because you cannot do anything unless everyone agrees. But it means that you have, at the very least, you have that harmony there in the sangha. And it works. This is the astonishing thing. It actually, you know, you can actually make decisions this way. Sometimes you have to be patient with your suggestions and kind of slowly, gradually convince everyone. But it does actually work, and you can make decisions about this. So you have this idea of unanimity as you meet, as you break up, and you carry on the business. So all the way through, everyone is present. And if someone is not present, then it doesn't actually work. So what is also interesting about this is that this concerns obviously not the whole Sangha in the world. You can't meet with the whole Sangha in the world. That's impossible. What it refers to is the local sangha in a particular community. And this is very clearly, again, described in the monastic vinaya. Sometimes people think that the monastic vinaya is all about kind of rules of conduct. You shouldn't do this, you should do that. But the monastic vinaya is also about how the sangha actually functions. Yeah, so how the sangha is supposed to do things, how they get out of disputes, how they get out of problems, how they meet, what kind of decisions they can make, what kind of decisions they can't make, how those decisions are made. So a lot about the procedural aspects of the sangha are also found in the vinaya. And those procedural aspects are actually very interesting, and in some ways perhaps more interesting than the rules in a certain way. Okay, the rules, we know what they are, of course, but these procedural aspects are more interesting because very often they are forgotten about. People don't practice these procedures. And for that reason, I think it actually weakens the sangha in the long run if you don't take these things on board and you practice them according to how they are laid down, especially here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it is the local sangha that is in charge of any decisions, and that local sangha is defined by a boundary called the sima in the Pali language. And any action that's done within that sima has to be performed by the local sangha. So if there is a visiting monk or a visiting nun coming to the monastery at a particular time, they too have to be included in that sangha decision. If a monk from the monastery happens to be traveling, well, then he's excluded because he's not within that sima at that particular time. So it is a local democracy happening within each place. It is not a kind of a massive thing, which happens kind of around the world, but it's a very local democracy. And what that means is that it is a very non-hierarchical structure. There's no hierarchy in this. You can't have a pope like you have in the Catholic Church, right? Catholic Church, incredibly hierarchical. One man at the top, and he's supposed to communicate with God. So you have God and the pope, and you have this pyramid coming down at the bottom. Interesting, of course, is that some of the early Buddhist pioneers who started to reform the sangha, it was in Thailand particularly, there was one of the pioneers to reform the sangha in Thailand, King Mongkut, one of the kings who lived in about the 1840s, 50s, or something like that. He was a monk for a while, very dedicated Buddhist, this particular king. And he, one of the things that he saw was the sangha was very corrupt at that time. And so he decided that they had to change things differently. And one of the things that he saw, because that was a time when Western ideas were being spread more in some of these Asian countries. And because Western ideas were there, and kind of the Western ideas looked kind of cool, because the Western powers are obviously very powerful, so okay, we got to look to these Western ideas. And one of the ideas was a Catholic Church, right? That was one of the ideas. Very interesting, because the Catholic Church is the exact opposite of the Buddhist principles. The Catholic Church is incredibly hierarchical. Buddhist ideas completely flat. So by taking on board these ideas of the Catholic Church, you are in very many ways destroying this beautiful ideal of early Buddhism, where it is completely flat. Every decision is taken in complete, absolute majority at the local level, and there is no oversight beyond that local level. So that's what happens sometimes when you kind of get the things the wrong way around. This, of course, is true in the present day in almost every Buddhist society, is that there is a degree of hierarchy there, an oversight from the top that was not there at the time of the Buddha so much. And it varies from one Buddhist culture to another one how strong these hierarchies are. I know in Sri Lanka, actually, it's not so hierarchical. In Sri Lanka, there is a lot of autonomy at the local level. They're still kind of formed into nikayas and these things, but there's much more autonomy at the local monastic level. Whereas in some of these other cultures, you have like the Sangha Raja on top. Sangha Raja, the king of the Sangha, right? That's literally what it means. The king of the Sangha is on top, and then you kind of It is very structured under that. So again, very useful to remember that the Buddha doesn't actually talk like this. The Buddha talks about a decentralized system. And I think that one of the great reforms that we would be great to have more of in the Buddhist world is to reform more towards back to those ancient ideals of decentralization, lack of kind of central control. Because obviously the Buddha obviously saw that that was the best way of running things, so presumably he had some insight into that. Okay, so that is the idea of doing things in unanimity. And of course, if you do things in unanimity in this way, it also tends then to lead to harmony at the same time, because you tend to think in the same way again, work together in harmony in the same way. Yeah. So that is the how the Sangha actually operates, or ideally should operate. And we will see it is not quite as simple as I have said now, because what I have said now, it sounds like everybody has exactly the same say. There is no one who has more say, but there is also the idea of having respect for the elders at the same time. That's also part of this thing. It comes in a couple of seconds, a bit further down, the idea of respecting those people who have a lot of experience. So there is a bit more of a balance than what I have let on, but essentially it is a completely decentralized democracy, the absolute democracy, the Sangha. Okay, next one. As long as they do not authorize, I should also say here before I go on that, of course, one of the problems is precisely that not enough monastics actually read these suttas, right? If they had read the suttas, if they had tried to understand what is there, then surely we would have been practicing more correctly, because it is so obvious. This is what the Buddha says. And everybody in Buddhism respects the Buddha, takes the Buddha as their teacher. So we would actually be doing these things. One of the problems with not reading the suttas is that you actually start to stray away from the message. You don't really get the results anymore. Things don't work out anymore. It's one of the problems of that. So reading the sutta actually is incredibly important to be able to have that guidance in life. Otherwise, you're just dependent on the abbot of your monastery. And if that is a great and wonderful abbot, then it's wonderful, because then it might work out reasonably well. But if it is not a great and wonderful abbot, then you have a problem. The idea of abbot, by the way, arose much later in Buddhism. It arose, nobody knows exactly when it arose, but it is talked about in the commentaries much later on. The idea of the abbot is called like the lord of the monastery or something like that. And of course then the power structure again started to arise with an abbot in the monastery. At Bodhinyana Monastery, do we have an abbot? I guess we do in a certain way. I guess we have sort of inherited that from Thailand. So, but it's more like a position, it's not a position whereby the abbot is kind of autocratic and kind of lays down the rule. Ajahn Brahm says, hey, everybody says yes, sir, and has to follow along. It doesn't quite work like that, but it's more, I think, for purposes such as who is going to represent Bodhinyana Monastery at the committee and that sort of stuff. But at the monastery, actually, it is fairly decentralized, although Ajahn Brahm, of course, has a very important position. Anyway, next one. As long as they do not authorize what has not been authorized already, and do not abolish what has been authorized, but proceed according to the rules that have been laid down. I'm just rearranging the word here a little, because I think that's a more correct way of looking at it. So they proceed according to the rules that have been laid down and authorized. So this is another one which shows you the importance of reading the suttas, right? The idea that you keep those rules that the Buddha has laid down, and you don't add heaps of new stuff that the Buddha never laid down in the first place. And this is an incredibly important principle if you are a monastic, because exactly what rules are we supposed to keep, right? And you find that there is a large layer of different types of rules. There are the rules found in the Vinaya and the procedures found in the Vinaya, which of course are absolutely crucial because they came from the Buddha's time. But even some of those rules, you could argue, well, maybe they're not really relevant in the present day. Why are we keeping these rules? And it is quite possible that the Buddha would have laid down different rules in the present day, right? Some of those rules seem a bit, you wonder why they are there. One rule is the like digging the earth, for example. And the reason why you can't dig the earth as a monastic is because it was considered at that time that earth had a life faculty. The earth was actually alive, in a sense. The Buddha says, he literally says, people perceive the earth as having a life faculty, therefore you should not dig the earth. He doesn't say that the earth has any faculties, but people perceive it that way, and so we have to kind of be careful so we don't kind of get a bad reputation, I suppose. And So some of those rules, you wonder whether he would have laid them down. There are even more other rules that are even more minor. Rules like, you know, your rules of etiquette. And etiquette, of course, changes over the from culture to culture, changes from centuries to centuries. And in those days, there were culture, things like, you know, if somebody is sitting down, you should not stand and give them a teaching. Because sitting down is considered a higher position. And that kind of makes sense. Even today, you know, that somebody of a high social position might sit down, the king might sit down on his throne, right, whereas his kind of attendants, they stand up or whatever. But there are also situations in the present day where it is the opposite, like a lecture hall in a theater. The lecturer might stand while all the students are sitting down. Yeah, this is a it doesn't mean that there's any disrespect there. It's just the way we do things in our culture. So some of these rules are not really applicable anymore in that sense. But still, most of these rules, because they are the word of the Buddha, we tend to keep them the way they are. Some of these minor rules actually don't actually have to keep them, because the Buddha said specifically only if you are doing it only if you just throw them out of disrespect, only then is there an offense. Otherwise, you don't have to keep them if there is a good reason for not keeping them. Anyway, so very useful, again, go back to the basics, right? It means that a lot of the rules that monks follow in the present day are not the word of the Buddha. A lot of the rules are rules found in the commentaries, found in certain cultures, found within certain monasteries, local rules, whatever they are, don't come from the Buddha. A classic example, I'll give you an example of this. This is Thailand, they have this idea of when you receive something with a receiving cloth, right? When you receive something from the opposite gender, you receive it on the receiving cloth. There's nothing about that anywhere in the Vinaya, not even in the commentaries. It's purely a Thai tradition. Yeah, so you put out a cloth, and a lady comes, she puts something there to offer to you, and then you do it. And I don't think it's a big problem, as long as it is the same way for both genders. The nuns do the same thing, that I think is okay, it's not a major issue. But the interesting thing is, if you go to Thailand, and I was there just over a year ago, and I met with one of these very impressive monks, a monk who is said by many people to be an arahant, right? Very soft, very gentle, very nice. Then he said to me, make sure you keep the Vinaya properly in Perth, right, in Australia, such as no shaking of the hands with women, and make sure you use the receiving cloth. Right? And this is the problem. Even if you are a monk who has incredibly good meditation, you're very wise in so many ways, the way that you have learned the Vinaya, you haven't learned the word of the Buddha. What you have learned is a cultural Vinaya, a cultural approach to these kind of things. So that's what they take to be the Vinaya in those situations. So this is one of those problems that arises from not actually reading the suttas. And even shaking a hand with a woman, you know, is not actually against the Vinaya as such. It is only if you shake the hand for the wrong reasons. But if you just shake the hand because you want to say hello, actually, there is not really a problem there. And very often in the West, you know, you go out, you meet some politicians or whatever, and a woman might put out her hand to shake your hand. Well, okay, so you shake the hand, and there's actually no issue there in those situations either. So keeping the rules, not adding new ones, right? And then actually when we do that, the Vinaya is also more flexible. It allows us to use it better in modern situations instead of kind of sticking too much to traditions and all of these kind of things. This is the interesting thing about the Vinaya. It actually isn't that rigid once you take away some of the commentaries and all of these extra extraneous things and go back to the basics. Actually, there's a lot of flexibility there, and it gives it more ability to act in a way that is appropriate in our modern society. I think that is important. Otherwise, we become really weird, complete weirdos, the monastic order, if we do all of these kind of strange things. I'm not going to get into any examples, but sometimes people are very rigid about these rules, and they say, oh, take off your shoes straight away, you can't offer me anything with your shoes on, or, you know, being very harsh. But if, as long as the other person doesn't mean disrespect, it's not an issue. It's a disrespect which is the issue. That is what you have to look for. Yeah. Okay, so that is the Vinaya, the monastic code, and how to live with that according to the ancient tradition of the Buddha himself. But of course, equally important, perhaps more important, actually more important, is the same thing also applies to the suttas, the word of the Buddha. That is even more important because that is where the real inspiration of the Dhamma arises from. That is where the practice really is understood, what the practice is all about is understood. The Vinaya arises from the Dhamma. The Dhamma is actually more basic than the Vinaya. The Vinaya is just the rules and procedures. The Dhamma is the actual things that we're trying to cultivate on this path. And of course, so that is even more important that we go back to the basics of that. What did the Buddha say is in the sutta, is the real Dhamma? What are later additions? Even more important in that particular area. Here, the emphasis is on the rules, but as we shall see later on in the suttas, exactly the same thing also applies to the suttas as well. So don't kind of write too many new suttas. Keep those old ones is a much better idea. Yes, please.
Why did the Buddha tell the monks to shave their eyebrows?
Why he said that? Okay, are you sure he said that?
No. I said why? I don't know if he did or didn't. Why was that for? Why do monks have to shave their eyebrows?
Yeah, okay, yeah. He didn't actually say that. Right? This is one of those things that have arisen afterwards. This arose in China, it's another Thai tradition. And it arose, I think, during a war or something like that. And there were some imposters coming from the outside dressing up like monks. And they decided to be able to stand out and look different from the other monks. They decided, I think, to shave their eyebrows. To be able to recognize those who were real monks from those who were not real monks. Something like that. That was the thing, the background. That's what I've heard anyway. Maybe it's just a myth. That's what I've heard. And then it has been like that ever since. You shave your eyebrows. But there is an argument that actually that's not really appropriate because eyebrows are, some people say it's not really hair of the head, it's like hair of the body. You're not really supposed to shave the hair of the body, apparently. Yeah. So there you are, yeah. I don't think it's kind of very, very harmful or very problematic. It probably doesn't really matter so much, but still. Yeah. Okay. So that is then the idea. And of course, this is why it is so interesting with all the kind of the research that people sometimes do. Research about the suttas, what is the earlier suttas, comparative research, looking at the language, which language is more original, and all of these kind of things, because it actually gets us back to the essence of what the Buddha taught. Gets us back to those things that he said should not be abolished, but should be kept, and the things that shouldn't be added. So all that actually has an important place in Buddhism. Okay, so next one. As long as the monks and the nuns and everyone honor, respect, revere, salute the elders of long standing who are long ordained, the fathers and leaders of the order. And what is missing here, quite important, which Maurice Walsh has missed out, is that they think that those leaders should be listened to, right? That's obviously quite important, but he has missed out that for some reason, probably maybe working a bit too fast or something. But that they should be listened to, obviously, is a very important factor there. Not just do you honor them and respect them, but you actually listen to what they have to say here. And this, of course, is an important balance here with the idea of absolute democracy. And this is the idea where you kind of understand that there are certain people who have more insight, more understanding, who have a knowledge of why things are done the way they are. So you don't get too kind of many revolutionary young monks. Usually the young monks, the young people are the revolutionaries, right? I remember myself always complaining to Ajahn Brahm, why are we doing all these rituals? Why are we doing all these stupid things? This is not what the Buddha said. We should be doing this and we're doing all this stuff. Ajahn Brahm said, okay, relax, you know, cool down. And which is actually very nice, right? Because sometimes you get a little bit too kind of keen on revolutionizing things. And if you really want to be a revolutionary, you should really have to start your own monastery and then kind of prove yourself from the bottom, I think. Yeah. So this is the nice thing about someone like Ajahn Brahm. You know, he then has that balance. He's actually surprised. He's actually a very conservative in some ways Ajahn Brahm. People think that he's like a revolutionary because he started the ordination of bhikkhunis here in Perth, but in some ways he is. He saw that as a very important thing to do for the Buddhist society, for the thriving of Buddhism in Australia and all these kind of things. But generally speaking, he's actually very conservative. He doesn't really make massive changes. You really have to work on him for a long, long, long time to make him change anything at all. I'm still working on him on certain things, you know, slowly, 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 it's kind of moving. It's like this, he's like this iceberg, weighs millions of tons, right? Oh, you have to really kind of push, the wind has to be very strong and keep on going for a long time. But it's kind of nice, so it means that you are really dedicated to that change. You really have to feel this is an important change, so you keep on pushing it for years and years and years. And recently, I've had some small breakthroughs in certain areas that I think are really, really important, which is really kind of nice. Ajahn Brahm has that flexibility. He just doesn't want to do things too fast or in a kind of haphazard way, anything like that. But he has, actually, he's very flexible in the end, and he doesn't cleave on to traditions for that sake. He's just careful with what he does. So listen to the elders, and then you get that nice balance within the monastic community here. Yes. Yeah. You don't have to put any weight on it at all, really, because a monastery is always completely self-run in this way. But of course, you have the possibility of doing it. If you think that you are unsure about something, whether you should do it or not, it's always nice to consult with somebody else to get some feedback. But actually, if you feel that you're doing the right thing, you are in the full right to do whatever you want within that monastery. Nobody from the outside really has any right to get involved in what you do in your monastery here. So, yeah, that is an important point. Okay, so that is the monks who have to be respected, the seniors have to be respected, the fathers and leaders of the order, etc. And I guess if you're in the Bhikkhuni Sangha, it would be the mothers, perhaps, the mothers and the leaders of the order. And then we have the next one. As long as they do not fall prey to desires that have arisen in them and lead to rebirth. So these desires that arise inside of you and lead to rebirth, what exactly is meant by this? And to understand what is meant by this, it is the best place to see that is in the Second Noble Truth, where it talks about the tanha, the craving, porno bhavika. Porno bhavika means rebirth leading. Porno again, bhavika existence, so re-existence if you like. And it is always there qualified as three types of craving, of desires that lead to rebirth in particular. Sensual craving, craving for existence, and craving for annihilation, right? The three types of craving that you see about. Bhavatana, vibhavatana, and kama tanha are the three Pali words for that. And of those three, by far the most important one is kama tanha, the craving for sensual pleasures of the world. That is by far the most important one because it is very... It is everywhere around us. It is always present pretty much. The bhavatana is a much more subtle thing. It is something that can be strong as well, but it's much more subtle in many ways. Whereas the karmatana, the desire for pleasures, because we all want pleasure, right? You can't live a life without pleasure. You have to have some happiness in life. And for most people, that pleasure comes through the senses. You enjoy your food, you enjoy your relationships, and all this kind of stuff. That is where these pleasures come from. So, you have to be careful about this, right? These kind of pleasures. And of course, the kama tanha, the craving for sensual pleasures, it happens largely in the city, when you live with other people, where you have access to all of these pleasures. If you live in the forest, you're kind of withdrawing a little bit from this. And this is why the next thing here is that you are devoted to forest lodgings. These are two kind of opposites in a sense. On the one hand, you have, if you don't live in the forest, if you live in the city amidst other people and all of these things that the city provides, city is really kind of a realm of sensuality and many other things as well, then it's very much more difficult to live the monastic life because you have to withdraw from these things a little bit to be able to deal with them. It's hard enough to deal with already, and if you get bombarded by these pleasures all the time, wow, it's so much more difficult if you have to do that. In fact, it becomes basically impossible, and that's why forest dwellings are are so important on these things. So this is the thing about the problem of the sensual pleasures in particular. And one of the things about sensual pleasures that I think people perhaps often underestimate, that this is the one force, if there is any force more than anything else, that keeps you tied to the wheel of samsara, it is precisely the sensual pleasures. Because they are the main happiness in our existence for most people. So there's something we're always pursuing. If you haven't got any of the happiness of the spiritual life, then those other things you will always go back to, fall back on those sensual pleasures. And as it says here, they are rebirth producing, right? And because they are rebirth producing, they are the ones that keep you rolling on from life to life, keep you on going again and again. There's that beautiful simile in the suttas, the simile of the dog, which shows you in many ways how this works and how it is that craving ties you to the round of rebirth. There's a simile of the dog that goes to the butcher shop, and he sits outside the butcher shop, right, looking up, waiting for some nice meat to come out, being thrown out of the butcher shop. The problem is that the butcher is not going to throw any nice meat to a dog. A dog is going to get the very best, some kind of dodgy remains that is left over. And especially perhaps in those days in India, meat was probably very valuable. There's no way the butcher is going to throw away anything at all, if possible. So when eventually the butcher throws something out, it is a bone without any meat, has a little bit of blood on it, right? So the dog, very happy, oh, finally a bone is coming. But then he starts to eat this bone, and there's no sustenance there. There's nothing to fill you up. There's nothing to kind of feel. You just chew, you get the taste of the blood. It kind of feels nice, it tastes nice, but there's nothing really there. And after a while, the dog is so disappointed, equally hungry, the craving hasn't been satisfied. Still, the problem is still there. Sensual desire hasn't really abated at all. So you move on to the next butcher shop, right? Waiting, oh, maybe this time the butcher will give me nice meat. Butchers don't give nice meat to dogs. Full stop. It doesn't happen, right? Just don't do that. So forget about getting some nice meat, but still waiting. Ah, please. Then comes out another bone with a little bit of blood on it. Yeah, hooray. Oh no, it's disappointing. Next butcher shop. And each butcher shop is like one life, right? Move on to the next life. Next one. Always hoping that blooming butcher shop is going to give you some nice meat. Every time, having exactly the same hope. Every time, being equally stupid, never learning your lesson that butchers don't actually give away meat to dogs. And we are exactly the same, running around from one relationship to the next one, in one life to the next one, running after the pleasures of the world, never understanding they're not going to give us that satisfaction that we are really craving for. Craving says to you, yes, follow me, do what I say you should be doing, then you will be satisfied. Feel that in your heart when desire arises, the desire says, you know, do this, and feel what it feels like, and what you will feel is precisely this lie inside of you. When you get this, you will be satisfied. But you won't. And we are so slow learners sometimes. Sometimes we need somebody like the Buddha to point these things out to us, to understand these things. But once it is pointed out, actually it is quite kind of obvious in a sense. And then, of course, what you do, instead of running around after craving all the time, following craving, like the slave of craving, as it says in a certain suttas, you kind of have a rope around your neck and being pulled along by craving. And then you realize, actually, maybe there's a different kind of happiness, which has satisfaction in the present moment, where you don't feel that craving anymore. You don't feel that you are always running after something, but actually you have a happiness where you feel complete and fulfilled and satisfied inside for the first time. And actually that happiness exists. And that happiness is the one you find on the spiritual path. And then when you go down that path and you reach that, then one day you actually get to that state that craving was always promising you. Craving was saying you get satisfied. Craving was lying. You go down this other path and you find exactly that thing that craving was promising you in the first place. Whoa, I've been looking in the wrong way. This is the problem in life. We're deluded. We don't really understand what's going on. And then you go in a different direction. So for this reason, craving is what binds you to this round, always looking to the future. Craving, desire is always about the future, right? I feel dissatisfied now, how can I find satisfaction? It's always this following after something, running after something, never actually getting there, projecting yourself from life to life, moving on, never learning that lesson. And this is the craving that leads to rebirth. Main aspect of that is the kama tanha, the craving for sensual pleasures. So this is why it is so important. Absolutely fundamental to the whole spiritual life to gradually move away from those sensual pleasures. If you don't, you will be tied onto that round of existence, which is precisely what we're trying to make an end of ultimately on this path. Then there is the craving for existence, which is just the feeling that you want to exist, right? Of course, this can be very, very subtle. You can go into deep states of meditation, and this craving for existence will be there, regardless of how deep you go. And that craving also will drive you on from life to life. I want to exist, I don't want to end, I don't want to come to an end, right? So again, you are kind of projecting yourself into the future. You want to keep going, in a sense. And then the craving for annihilation, again, a very similar kind of thing. It's this ignorance, this delusion that we exist, but existence isn't really worthwhile. Because it isn't worthwhile, we want to be destroyed. But that destruction itself is always a future state. And for that reason, you are actually propelling yourself from one life to another one by that very craving which wants to annihilate yourself. It's kind of tragic. I want to be annihilated. And then kind of the world says, no way, you're going to continue on even though you want to be annihilated. You have no choice in the matter here. So these are the cravings that lead to rebirth. And these are the things that you have to overcome as a monastic. And not allow yourself to be, to fall prey to these things, fall under their control. The vasangacchati means to fall under control of these things. For that reason, as I was saying, the most important one being the sensual desire, this is why monks ideally and nuns ideally should live in the forest, why lay people too sometimes should go on a retreat, stay away sometimes to experience more of that happiness of the mind, the happiness that comes through spiritual practice. And this ties then directly in with the next one here, which is as long as those monks and nuns are devoted to forest lodgings. Sapeka literally means you are craving for them. You are longing for those forest lodgings, right? This is, again, to me, very fascinating because it is so different from how we see monasticism in the vast majority of the world these days. The vast majority of monastics live in the cities, in the villages, they do social work and all kind of stuff. And the amount of monastics that actually truly live in the forest is actually a very, very small number. And yet, despite that, the very future of Buddhism, it says here, depends on monastics living in the forest, getting out of the cities, getting away from the sensual pleasures, getting away from the hustle and bustle, all the problems and the noise and the attachments and involvements that the world outside actually entails. So this is how important it is. Again, if people had read the suttas and they had seen this kind of thing, they would have said, that's how important it is. I'm going to leave my current teacher and go off to the forest instead and live in a proper forest monastery. That is how important it is. The entire future of Buddhism actually depends on this kind of thing here. So very important, right? So again, something that is really significant for monks and nuns to reflect on, also for the lay people. It shows you, where the main kind of main support for monastics should be. And it's always good to kind of urge monastics to live in the forest in a sense, because you know that is actually the way forward for Buddhism into the future. So you support that. You try to kind of, make that movement happen yourself as lay people. Lay people also have some degree of influence in Buddhist things, depending on how you support things, what kind of things you say to the monastics, all these kind of things. So it's not as if monastics don't listen to lay people. They do. They have to. There's not much choice about the matter because we have this mutual relationship. And because of that, you have some degree of power, right, to help these things along in the right way. Although, of course, the monastics are much more important that the monastics do these things. Still, there is that mutual thing there. just to bring out this sutta that Ajahn Brahm often talks about, found in the Anguttara Nikaya, which kind of underlines this, which you've probably heard many times before, but anyway, worthwhile saying one more time perhaps. And that is a sutta where the Buddha is walking around, looking at his monastics, and he sees one monk sitting on the edge of the village. And he sits on the edge of the village in really well, really nicely, you know, obviously meditation going really well, sits very straight without moving. And most people in the present day would say, well done, you're practicing well. You know, most people often say, it doesn't matter so much where you do things or how you do things. What matters is that you get the results. Yeah, that's a kind of a standard thing you will hear in the world. What matters is that we get the result. As long as we get the results, it doesn't really matter so much how you get those results. Wrong, right? It's not correct. It matters how you get the results. This is what is so interesting about this. You know, people often say, yeah, I'll do things my way. I'll do the way things work for me. Again, it's not actually correct. It's actually the wrong way of thinking. It may work. Have you got enough oversight to really understand what works for you in the long run and what works for Buddhism in the long run? Nobody has that big vision of things. It's impossible to have that kind of big vision. You almost have to be a Buddha to stand above it all and to look down and see, having ended all the defilements, then you're able to have that broad vision, the bird's eye view, where you can look down and you can decide what actually works and not. But for the vast majority of us, we still have so much delusion there, which blinds us to what actually matters. So because of that, then the Buddha moves on. He sees this fellow, this monk, sitting at the edge of the village and says, well, soon enough, he will be disturbed. Too close to the village, people will come, they will start chatting to him and all those kind of things, and then he will lose that meditation that he already has. It's not just about getting meditation, it's about sustaining it and taking it further. And that is what this monk has forgotten. And then he goes into the forest and he sees the monk in the forest nodding away. Right? I feel a bit like that today because I've got a bit of a cold. I don't feel all that awake actually, but I can't really nod while I'm reading, so it's I've got to be careful there. So nodding away in the forest, right? And most people would say, yeah, you know, that monk, no good, right? He shouldn't be nodding in the forest like that. But of course, the Buddha praises him, which is very interesting here. He praises that, yes, this monk, he's doing the right thing. He will soon overcome that tiredness. And when he overcomes that tiredness, then his samadhi will be well established and he will be able to practice in the right way. It's astonishing. The vast majority of people would say the exact opposite. But the Buddha, of course, has a much broader view of these things. It's not just the results you have. It's the whole context that matters, what the Buddha is saying. And this is how important living in the forest actually is. So very, very fascinating. Goes against how we often think about these things. Yes, sir.
So the forest lodgings, I mean, yeah, obviously has to apply to the majority and not to the one or two who are adept at jhanas. I mean, so that is defined as 1 kilometer from the nearest city?
Yeah, that's basically the definition. So 1 kilometer from the nearest dwelling, other dwelling here, right? So there should be at least 1 kilometer to the nearest other place where people are staying here, farms, yeah. That's how it's usually defined. But, you know, I mean, you can have a little bit of flexibility there as long as you are. So Bodhinyana, actually, Bodhinyana Monastery, is, according to all the standards of India, a real forest monastery. Yeah? We are at least 1 kilometer from the nearest dwelling in any direction. Dhammasara, I think, possibly as well. Because if you look at the nearest buildings in Dhammasara and you look out to the nearest, I'm not sure, I haven't measured it, but I think quite possibly that too is a forest monastery, I think. But, yeah, anyway. Yes.
That might have been okay in the time of the Buddha, forest lodgings, but nowadays many monks don't have that opportunity. Many monks are nuns. So are you saying they can't practice properly, or, you know?
How come they haven't got the opportunity?
Well, if you're living in a country where there's no forests, no forest monasteries, if you're living in Tibet in the high mountain regions, there's no forests.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
That means they can't practice correctly because they're not in the forest. That doesn't make sense.
Okay, so first of all, I should change the translation. It's not really forest as such. It is wilderness outside of inhabited areas. So if it is Tibet and there is no forest, it's fine as long as we live outside the inhabited areas. That's what really matters. That's an important point. So it can be a desert, you know, you can live in a cave in the sand or something like that if you want to. Or it can be anywhere like that, or in Norway, maybe a snow cave in the winter time there. So anywhere which is far away is really perfectly acceptable. But I don't think that's the biggest problem isn't that people can't live in this way. The biggest problem is that people don't incline towards these things. Yeah. If people really incline towards it, more people will be living in the forest. There is still quite a bit of forest left in Thailand if you know where to go, if you know the right places. There's certainly enough wilderness places. I've been there. I've seen some of these wilderness places. They're quite far away, really secluded. The biggest problem is not the possibility. The biggest problem is actually just the understanding of what constitutes real Buddhist practice. That is the real problem. The lack of reading the suttas, lack of reading the Mahapranibbana Sutta, that is the real issue at stake. Yeah, I think a lot more people would actually do the right thing if they had kind of taken these things on board properly. Yeah. There may be certain cases where you're right, where it's very difficult. Sure, you know, we shouldn't kind of condemn people. And that's not what I want to do anyway. I don't want to condemn anyone because the reason why people live in the city is because that is how they have been taught by their teachers. Is it just the way things are? What I want to do, rather than condemn anyone, is to try to see, well, how can we change things carefully? And one of those things is just by reading the suttas, starting with that point. And once you start to read the suttas, these things actually come out. It becomes obvious, right? So incline people, well, maybe read the suttas. Why are you just reading books by kind of contemporary teachers? Isn't the Buddha kind of the teacher of the teachers? Isn't he the kind of the final authority on all these things? You have a point, actually, about reading the suttas. It says here, I should live in the forest. Okay, off I go to the forest. That's the ideal way of doing things, rather than criticizing people. Because people do things for a reason, usually. Yeah? Yeah? Happy? Not looking tired? Are you all right? Yeah? 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 Okay? Yeah? John? Yeah? 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 Yeah, great. Okay. Okay, so we will move on to the next one. So, being devoted to forest lodgings is so important in the Buddhist practice. And of course, that is also interesting from many other points of view, is that you can, that's where often you will expect people to have attainments, right, who have success on the Buddhist path will be those people who live in those forest lodgings. And there are still quite a number of monastics who do live in these things. You travel to Sri Lanka or to Thailand, and you do find in Burma, I've never been to Burma, but I presume it's the same thing there, and you do find some very wonderful places where people are devoted to this kind of practice. So it is still happening, and that is where you are most likely to find people who have that insight of the teachings, to really understand what is going on. Okay, the last point of this list. As long as they preserve their personal mindfulness, so that in future the good among the companions will come to them, and those who have already come will feel at ease with them. It is not a very good translation, in my opinion. What he is saying here is that you should remember how it is that people, the good companions, come to you, and those who have already come to you, they stay with you. You should keep that in mind. That's what it really means. So you remember, okay, how can we make sure that the good companions in the holy life, the Pesala Brahmacharya, it said here, how can we ensure that they come, and that those good ones who already are here, how they stay with us? And these Pesala Brahmacharya, the good companions in the holy life, these are, of course, anyone who practices in the right way, who practices well. Yeah, it doesn't say, interesting here, it doesn't say the Aryas or the noble ones or the Arahants or the awakened ones or anything like that. And, of course, the reason why it doesn't say that is because it's very hard often to know who these people are. All you can say, well, this person is practicing well, this one not so well. So ideally, we want more of those people who practice well. That's really all you can say. And you want to kind of invite them and make sure we have them around. And once they have come, to make sure you treat them in such a way they want to stay around for a long time. And this is, again, one of those very interesting things, in my opinion, the fact that this is so important. This is the idea that you have the good monastics, the good people are in your company, in your society, is so, again, fundamental. This is the idea of the Kalyanamitta, right? Who are the real Kalyanamittas in the world? Kalyanamitta being the good spiritual friend. Number one Kalyanamitta is the Buddha. Number two Kalyanamitta are all the Aryans, the ones who actually have seen these teachings. Number three Kalyanamitta are all the other people, the monastics perhaps in particular, but all the other people who practice well and do the right thing here. And what is so fascinating about the whole idea of Kalyanamitta is that it is such a foundation stone for the whole teaching, for the whole practice to even be possible. Without the Kalyanamitta, there is no movement forward. You are stuck, basically, because we're all starting off with the wrong view. We need somebody who sees for us, somebody who is the eye of the world, as the Buddha said to be. Then they can pass on the information to us. Otherwise, there's nothing much we can do. We are stuck. And the whole practice of Buddhism starts off with the idea of Kalyanamitta. That's where it all begins. And without that, there is no kind of movement forward. And what is so fascinating is that it's not just that it starts off with that, but it needs to be continuously nurtured by Kalyanamittas. You have to hang around these Aryans. You have to hang around the word of the Buddha. You have to make sure you have good company. You are in company with the right people. So you always have that boost, right? These little rockets in your bottom that kind of keep you, you know, moving in the right direction. Yeah. So you kind of it makes you move in the right way, like the ship on the ocean. This is one of the ways I like to look at human beings. Human beings are like a ship on the ocean, which has no steering mechanism, no engine, anything like that. So because you have no steering mechanism, no engine, no sails, no oars, no paddle, nothing like that, it means that you are entirely dependent on the wind and the current of the ocean. You will drift according to the wind and the current. So if you want to get to point A, and you are completely reliant on the wind and the current, what are you going to do? You have to make sure you get the right wind, right? You have to make sure you fall into the right current. Then you will move to point A. So if point A is Nibbana over here, the right wind and current to get you to point A is the teaching of the Buddha. They will kind of make sure you move over there. Haven't got the teaching of the Buddha, you will go in different directions. So this is the whole point here with the idea of Kalyanamitta. It is something which drives you in the right direction. And you have to keep that going, keep on nurturing it with Kalyanamitta. There's a beautiful simile that I have talked about here before, which is really, really nice, which kind of drives home this point of the importance of Kalyanamitta. It's a simile of the rain on the mountaintop. Lots of mountaintops in the Buddhist similes, because mountaintops are kind of cool, right? And mountaintops, I don't know, I find it personally, I really like mountains. I just came back from Java recently, and I saw all the volcanoes over there. It's quite kind of astonishing to see all these volcanoes. There's something very powerful and majestic about mountains. It reminds you of, the Buddhist teaching, perhaps, in a certain way. But this simile is about the rain falling on the mountaintop. And as it rains on that mountaintop, gradually the rain forms into little streams. Right? And it keeps on raining. As the rain keeps on raining, those little streams form into little lakes. They go into little lakes. And if you keep on raining, those little lakes overflow into the large lakes. If it keeps on raining, those large lakes overflow and go into the large rivers. And eventually, those large rivers go into the ocean. Those large rivers ultimately are sourced by the rain falling on the mountaintop. Yeah, even if it is a glacier, the glacier is also formed by snow, by precipitation, ultimately. Yeah? So keep on raining. If you keep on raining long enough, the water will end up in the ocean and fill up the great ocean. And the rain here is a simile for the Kalyanamitta, for hearing the good teachings. And the ocean is a simile for Nibbana itself. So as long as you keep on that rain coming, as long as you keep that input, keep on the wind coming from the right direction, then you will eventually move to Nibbana as a consequence. It takes a while because there are many steps in between, but you get the idea there, what's going on. Very nice simile, in my opinion. This is the importance of keeping the Aryans among us, the noble ones, the ones that really know what they're talking about, right? And they're boosting you in the right way. And when you do that, whoa, that's when the results really start to happen. Beginning of the path and all the way to the end. So, Then, the last thing he says, as long as the monks hold to these seven principles and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. And of course, expected to prosper means the monastic order, but it also means Buddhism in general. So these are some of the core aspects to make Buddhism actually work out properly here. So, there you are. I'm not going to go any further because now we come back to where the things I did before. So then we have to jump a few pages forward. It's just this thing I left out for some reason. And it's terrible to leave this thing out because I think it's such a crucial and beautiful part of the sutta. So I have almost made a massive blunder there. Made the same kind of blunder that those people who don't read the suttas make by skipping an important part. So, are there any? Do you have any further comments on this or questions about this? Yes. Yeah. We talk. Yeah.
Regarding your last remark about making sure that the great practitioner, the great master, will come.
Yeah.
So that part, I didn't really get the gist of your messages.
Yeah.
To preserve our own practice so that naturally the good ones will come and teach, or what?
I think the idea here is just to remember. It's memory. It's not preserving mindfulness. It's just to keep in mind. That's what it means. Keep in mind, how can we act in such a way that these people will come and those who are already here will stay here? So keep that in mind, right? So how can we make the Buddhist society work in such a way that nice, good monastics will come here, good lay people as well for that matter, and those who are already here, how they will stay on in the future? Huh? So that's really all it means. But sometimes the translations here are there's lots of nice, good things to be said about this translation. The English is quite nice, quite colloquial English, and that is great. But sometimes it also gets it slightly wrong, I think, the way it translates. So, okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Eddie.
So Ajahn Brahmari.
Yeah.
Regarding the earlier part, regarding sensual pleasures.
Yeah.
Don't you think the Buddha's rule, there's a distinction between his rule to monks and nuns and lay people, That's to my understanding, you see. Not to his 100% disciples, yes. The monks and nuns, he forbid sensual pleasures. It leads to suffering. But for lay people, there is a sutta, a long-worded sutta, It says it is not the sensual, it's not the desire that's a problem, It's the craving, the clinging, wanting all the time. Yeah. That leads to the suffering,
Yeah.
And this woman, and he did acknowledge, that lay people, we still have desires.
Okay.
If we don't have it, he, in the suttas, it's suffering, So what he is trying to say is, desire is okay for lay thing, be aware that it's impermanent. Don't cling to it. Because when the passion goes down, if you cling to it, then you suffer. Then he laid rules for lay, the third precepts, Do not commit adultery or having, sex with underage people, all these things. He did guidelines to help lay people.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's a true distinction?
Okay, So the answer to that is that, even monks, you like your food, sometimes you have sensual pleasures as well. It's not as if you are completely outside of sensual pleasures either. But the point is that it's not so much that it's okay to have desire, it's just craving. Craving and desire are really the same thing, maybe slightly different intensity perhaps. They're really the same thing. But the idea is that it's a gradual movement. Right? This is the thing. So you don't kind of cut off all your pleasures in life. If you cut off all your pleasures right away, you could have a miserable life. So you make sure you have some pleasures. And then you gradually move away from the sensuality while at the same time moving towards the happiness of spiritual side. That is the right way of doing it. And that is exactly the same whether you are a layperson or a monastic. As a monastic, maybe you are trying to kind of hurry the process a little bit by kind of living the monastic life. But essentially the idea is the same. And that's why one day, some lay people live lives almost like monastics, They live lives where they live in by themselves, complete celibate, and they kind of practice a lot. And it's astonishing how some lay people are able to live really, really wholesome and good lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about matters of degree, really, I would say, rather than there's no absolute difference between the two.
Yeah. It's a gradual process.
Yeah.
That's why it's good on the thing. Because he did acknowledge, that lay people, you still have that, this part of the makeup of a human being, you still have that desire, you just can't suddenly cut off the things, isn't it?
Yeah. You can't cut it off straight away, you have to do it gradually. Yeah. Yes. That is correct. Yeah. Okay. Everybody else happy? Yeah. Okay, great. Okay. Yes. Oh, okay, sure. Okay, some overseas as well. Okay, great. Yeah. I think it's really cool that we have questions from overseas. Actually, I really like that. Okay. So, all of these are from overseas. Yeah, not always the case. This is from first one from Laurel in the USA. How can one deal with people who are in power and want to sabotage one's achievements when one wants to just reside in harmony? Thank you. How can you deal with people who are in power and want to sabotage your achievements? Well, this is one of those things, is that life is always full of people who do all kinds of things, right? There are nice people, there are bad people, there are power-hungry people, there are humble people, all kinds of people. And we just have to understand that the world is like this. This is one of the things about kind of accepting the world for what it is. It is impermanent. It is unreliable. It is always subject to change. There's always things that are difficult. It's suffering. All of these things are part of the world. So the way to deal with that is, in a way, to have compassion for them, right? This is really the right way of dealing with people like that. Because if somebody truly is sabotaging other people's achievements, if they truly are abusing their power in this way, they are creating terrible mind states for themselves. They're creating really bad karma in their lives. These are not going to be happy people. They're not going to feel any contentment or happiness inside. And in fact, they're moving towards more and more misery. And from a Buddhist point of view, they might very well get reborn in a difficult situation in a future life. So people like that, whenever there are people who are difficult, the answer is always to have compassion towards them, because they are creating far more suffering for themselves than they are creating for anybody else. This is kind of a critical thing. The amount of suffering they create for themselves is far more than the suffering they're creating for anyone outside. And once you understand that, then you can have compassion, because you know that everybody wants to be happy. Everybody thinks that they are creating happiness for themselves. And here is somebody who thinks that they are creating happiness for themselves, while in fact creating suffering. Why is that happening? Because they are deluded. They have no idea what's going on. They're completely confused about reality, about how things work. So once you see that, you feel sorry for them, basically, right? And often you can't help. You can't actually tell them anything, because they're not going to listen to you anyway. Because they're sure, like most people, they're sure that what they're doing is right. So you have compassion for them. You think, wow, actually, it's really sad that people should be this way. I hope they're able to change. I hope they're able to take on board some spiritual message and actually become better people. What a wonderful thing that would be if that was the case. And maybe you, if you have more compassion, more understanding, instead of reacting to them, you react to them with kindness and compassion, maybe that will have an effect on them, that they will be able to change. So very often, the reason people are stubborn about their conduct is because they feel other people are attacking them. You are doing the wrong thing, you should do this. No way, I'm going to do it my own way. But if you come from compassion instead, people are often more willing to listen and will often have more ability to see their own problems as a consequence. So this is the first thing, to understand the nature of things. There's always going to be difficulties like that. This is just the way the world is. Two, react to it in the right way, which is always in Buddhism about compassion, understanding. Perhaps this person even has good qualities, and you can actually rejoice in those good qualities. And the third thing to do is to be careful with yourself, to give yourself a little bit of room around people like that. If it is very difficult, maybe move away a little bit more so you don't have so much interaction with that kind of people. I don't know what situation you are in, whether it's a family situation or work situation or just friends or whatever, but a little bit more space for yourself so you're able to protect yourself is also important in these things. Otherwise, you drown in these kind of things, and then it becomes very unpleasant and very difficult to react in the right way. So try some of that and see what happens. Yeah, good luck here. Okay, next one is from Wolfram in Germany. There is one of the precepts from monks is not to play, sing, and dance. It is an expression of joy. What is wrong with that? Okay, that's a very sweet message. Yeah, so I agree with you. Sometimes, you know, you play joy and sing and dance, and it is an expression of joy. But remember that the point of the Buddhist path is not to be joyless and to be kind of killjoys and destroy everyone's happiness. That's not really the point here. The point is to move towards a greater happiness, right? So the idea from a Buddhist point of view is that these things are, in a sense, a lower kind of happiness. They are happiness, but they are lower on the scale. And the problem is that if you indulge in the lower happinesses, the higher happiness is out of reach. That's why you are celibate as a monastic, because you want to increase the possibility of reaching those higher happinesses. Yeah, so there is a contrast, there is a mutual contradiction between the two. If you indulge in one, you can't get the other, basically. Why is that? Because the sensual pleasures are always external. They're about going into the world. The other ones are internal. If you are attached to external things, you can't let go of that. It means you cannot go inside of yourself and enjoy the peace and happiness of meditation, that sort of thing. They are mutually contradictory. So this is why, as monastics, we do this. But it doesn't mean that we are completely, utterly boring and hopeless people, anything like that. If you come to the monastery, sometimes we joke around a lot. We're quite light-hearted. We don't try not to take things too seriously. You know, we mess around a little bit. We don't exactly sing and dance. We're probably going too far, but you know, we do enjoy things. We're not kind of very serious and really kind of gritting our teeth all the time. This kind of stuff. Ajahn Brahm tells the story from Thailand when Ajahn Chah, who was Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand, one of the most famous monks in Thailand in the 20th century, very impressive meditation master from Thailand, and he was very light-hearted and jovial and joking all the time, apparently. Well, maybe not all the time, but a lot of the time. And Ajahn Brahm tells the story when he saw the second monk in the monastery, who is now the abbot of Wat Pa Phong. Ajahn Brahm saw Ajahn Chah was telling so many. He was being so funny that this other monk, he was rolling around on the floor holding his tummy because he was laughing so much. He was almost like bursting in laughter. These were monks, right? People don't have that kind of picture of monks. That's sometimes what happens. In front of lay people, we look really kind of serious and tough. But behind the scenes, we're more kind of relaxed and easygoing. So it's all about balance, doing things in the right way. That's really what it's about. So I hope it makes sense what I'm saying. If not, then come back next week. Okay, next one is Milika from Serbia. How can we relate question of bhikkhuni ordination with the rule that all in the local sangha must approve every decision? Why Ajahn Brahm had so many difficulties? Thank you. Well, this is the whole point. This is the point, is that the sangha, all decisions should be made on the local level, but the way the sangha works these days is much more as a pyramid, much more hierarchical. And because that's how the sangha works these days, that's why you got into the problem. But if the sangha had worked according to the original ideas, teachings of the Buddha, there wouldn't have been any problem, because people would have realized, actually, it's none of their business what we're doing here in Australia. That's why this happened. Yeah, and this is, so yeah, so thank you for that question, because it's probably good to spell these things out sometimes. It doesn't mean that, you know, you don't necessarily blame the people who were part of that hierarchy, because this is how we have been brought up as monks, within this hierarchy. So people kind of, you know, we have used those. So there's no point in blaming anyone, but it's just that is how things have kind of, things have happened, and that's why that was so problematic at that particular time. But it really shouldn't have been, so it shouldn't in the big picture of things, that's what happened at that time. Okay, so I hope that is all good. Anyone else want to say anything? Last chance? No? Okay, great, let's pay respect to Buddha Sangha.